This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The tears of Suarez, the joy of Heung-min Son, more late drama in Qatar. South Korea hadn't really threatened to get a winner against Portugal until Son set off on his merry run. And finally he found a teammate, Wang, bolting forward to send them through to the knockouts. They had to wait though as Uruguay desperately tried to get the third goal they needed, but missed chances, unsuccessful penalty shouts, and it was all over. Ghana's hopes had gone when Wilson's favourite Ayew, Andre, blew their chance from the penalty spot. Great for the narrative, if nothing else. Group G was less topsy-turvy. Switzerland were in control for most of it and came through in the end. Shaqiri being Shaqiri and a wonderful goal from Remo Freuler. Brazil were always through. They sent out their reserve team to spin around against Cameroon and it didn't come to life until the last minute. Abubakar, a brilliant header and then a very casual red card. Also today we'll start previewing the knockouts. Question why any England fan is thinking more than one game ahead. We'll answer your questions and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Ed Ahrens, welcome.
Hi, Max.
Hello, Nader Manuaha.
Hello, Max.
And hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
All right, then. Let's start in Group H. Portugal go through on 6 points. South Korea through on goals scored. The same number of points as Uruguay. Ghana finished bottom with 3. That's after South Korea beat Portugal 2-1. Uruguay won 2-0 against Ghana, but it didn't matter in the end. Jim says, a smiling Sonny and a sobbing Suarez was what we all wanted to see, wasn't it? Matty sent a picture of Suarez crying and said, hang it in the Louvre, question mark. And Michael said, following the discussion about Lukaku on yesterday's pod, about it's okay to laugh at footballers making mistakes or whatever, I assume we can add Luis Suarez to the okay to find funny list. I mean, it was extraordinary end. Again, you know, like South Korean team, Nadim, in the centre circle, looking at their phone while the Uruguayans are haranguing a referee or any official they could find over this not given penalty. It was a brilliant end to a really fun afternoon.
Yeah, it was spectacular. I think as the game was going on initially, I thought, well, this is okay. This is okay. But then as soon as that second goal went in for South Korea, you then start thinking about all the different permutations and situations and like the fact that the South Korea game kicked off a little bit ahead of the Uruguay game. So you're thinking, oh, there's going to be like 7 minutes extra beyond this one. And what happens if they score this and the stress and the pain? It was so, so good. Like I absolutely loved it. And do you know, at the end, when I'm seeing Ghana think that they need to score and looking at Uruguay thinking they need to score and both teams are flying back and forth, but like really badly, it's like, yeah. Well, maybe this is why you're going out. You know, it was absolutely fantastic. And yeah, it brought a smile to my face. Not necessarily to see Suarez crying, although, you know, some people said that Ghana game wasn't going to lead to wasn't about revenge. But when you're time wasting and you're 2-0 down, you're already out. It kind of feels like revenge. So it was good fun. And for those who don't like Suarez, I'm sure they had a good moment. And for those that do, you know, he felt the pain as he cried, as he pointed up at the screen and realized there were 15 minutes left to go, basically. And he had no control over what was going to happen next.
Baz, that South Korea goal, right? It almost feels like it's the first thing that Heung-min Son has done in this World Cup that's come off. It feels like for 3 games, he's just like run down blind alleys or missed chances or looked sad. And suddenly this wonderful run. And then the ground that Hwang makes up is extraordinary.
Yeah. And as the goal came out of nowhere because South Korea were kind of long past the point where they should have been throwing the kitchen sink at Portugal. And they just seemed to be meandering, you know, in a quite relaxed fashion out of the tournament. There was no real urgency about their play. And on 2 occasions prior to the goal, Son had made runs down the centre and he had runners either side of him. And on both occasions, he ran into traffic without picking out either of those runners. It was making me think, God, is he wearing a face mask or is he wearing a set of blinkers, you know, like, you know, on a racehorse? Because he wasn't lifting his head and looking around. And far be it for me to tell Son how to play football. But yeah, I mean, where he got the energy for that gallop, another racehorse analogy, and that gallop from box to box. And the pass to Wang, who made up that ground, despite having a dicky hamstring, which has prevented him from playing in any of South Korea's games yet. That was the only sign of urgency they showed, really. It was throwing him on in the hope he'd get a goal. The ball through to him, perfectly timed. He managed to stay onside, and the finish was sublime. And it was all done at lightning speed. So hats off to them. And then that really put the cat amongst the pigeons, didn't it?
It really did. Because then everybody, like Nadim says, Ed, flicks to the other channel if they weren't watching it anyway to watch this sort of insane injury time where, you know, Suarez, they keep cutting to Suarez, who's crying on the bench, who's got his shirt over his head. Then Cavani has that header that's tipped over. There's that possible penalty. Then Coates makes this amazing block to, like, stop Ghana from scoring. And that the ball goes down the other end. It was just that sort of 9 minutes was just incredible.
Yeah, it was unbelievable drama, wasn't it, at the end? And I think, you know, the moment that everybody will remember is when, you know, Suarez found out about South Korea's goal, and everybody on the Uruguay team suddenly realised that the goalpost had moved and that, you know, they had to score another goal. And it's just this utter panic. And, you know, for Ghana, it was a really, it must have been a strange feeling at the end, because I think, you know, they all look really sad, obviously, because they'd been knocked out. But some of them must have been quite, you know, sort of laughing inside as well at Suarez and, you know, what happened to him, and yeah, particularly because, you know, he'd had such a great game as well. He, you know, two assists for the opening goals. It looked like, you know, the script was written with the penalty earlier on that just completely knocked the wind out of Ghana, and they lost their heads a little bit. But yeah, at the end, I think, you know, Uruguay were felt very hard done by with those decisions. But I think this Salisu just got the slightest touch on the ball, didn't he, for that one that looked the most like a penalty, and just got away with it. And then Ghana, yeah, like you say, were on the attack and should have scored, really, to bring it back. And then they would have been a goal away from qualifying as well. So, but yeah, I have to feel sorry for them a little bit. But yeah, but at least Uruguay didn't get through.
Yeah. So to talk about my experience over here in Qatar, so I did go to the Portugal versus Uruguay game, and it looked like in the first half for Uruguay, they must have been told that if you score, you will never play again for your country. So that's the type of energy that they had. So as a consequence, for them to lose out by one goal, well, yeah, you know, there's a bit of, exactly, there's a bit, yeah, of balance there. For such a potentially good side, to see them play the way that they played, it was really, really confusing. But they do have some level of fight within them, and they will be disappointed. And, you know, we also need to keep an eye on that injury to Bentancur as well, because I think he was probably the best player throughout the whole tournament. For him to go off when he did, you know, it's not that long now before we start talking about the that other league that we tend to cover a little bit. So yeah, Uruguay, really, really bizarre team. They play really well. Then half time is like, well, I guess that's enough. Well, there's the jeopardy for you. As soon as another team scores, before you know it, you're in a very, very tough position.
Barry, was that a penalty? The one on Cavani right at the end, where Ben's been in touch to say, a lot of people saying Cavani was fouled, but it seems to me that he slowed down to get the contact and the ref made a correct, brave decision. What do you reckon?
I thought it was a penalty. Seydou on Cavani, I thought it was a stupid challenge. And I thought he was very lucky to get away with it. And I'm not sure how Cavani slowing down to draw the foul makes it any less of a foul. I mean, there was... yeah, it's still a foul, no matter what speed you're going at, or if you're trying to draw it from the defender. So, yeah, I thought it was unquestionably a penalty. I can understand the frustration of the Uruguayan players at the end of the game when they were basically chasing the ref down the tunnel, and he was just brandishing yellow cards willy-nilly. I'd be interested to see if he actually got a record of who he showed them to, so he could make it included in his report. But yeah, it was definitely a penalty, and it was strange that the lads in VAR HQ seemed to, you know, move on so quickly and didn't at least get the ref to go and have a look at his pitch side monitor. I'm sure they reviewed it, but they came to the wrong conclusion as far as I'm concerned.
I'm guessing the referee's probably seen that there was contact, but doesn't believe it was, like, he thought legs just came together or whatever. I don't know. I hold my hands up. VAR has basically exposed me for not knowing the laws of the game. I just used to play it. You know what I mean? I used to get told when I made an offence, not knowing which one it was myself. When you get to the point whereby you think that the deciding moment for your World Cup was a penalty that wasn't given, when you had basically the cards all in your hand, like, yeah, you can tell they're frustrated. Like, that's the thing. It wasn't the 10 minutes of 7v4s in your favor when you're doing these counterattacks and you've got Cavani crossing it for Coates. You know, did they draw that up on the tactics board? I'd like to think that they didn't. So yeah, that decision, they can say it's wrong and so on, but you know, their tournament was done before that moment. And if they needed to rely upon a decision being given to them like that to give themselves the chance, then, you know, take a real good look at yourself and don't feel outraged because, you know, you kind of did this to yourself, you could say.
Ed, do you think South Korea deserved to go through? I mean, it feels like actually it was quite an even group. And I wondered out of the big teams, in inverted commas, Portugal might be the ones that struggle. And they've probably done quite well, actually, to get through. And Uruguay and Ghana could have got through on a sort of different set of days.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's the advantage of playing the team that's already qualified to get through. You know, we saw with Tunisia the other day, they came pretty close to getting through after being a second string France team. Although, yeah, I mean, Portugal was pretty much a second string team today with Ronaldo in it, of course, but... yeah, I think Ghana were the team that should feel particularly annoyed with themselves, I think, because it was in their hands today, especially, you know, with the penalty as well at the start. And if Ayew had stuck that away and banished the ghosts of 2010 with that goal, I was in that at the game back then in South Africa, and just it's a moment that just will haunt Ghana, and it will continue to haunt them now because of that miss. It's really quite annoying, actually, because I think if they scored that, I think they might not have gone on to win, but they'd have been in a really strong position. But, you know, South Korea are a good team as well. And they just took advantage of Portugal and got the win they deserved. Yeah, good for them.
Barry, so, I mean, that penalty was a sort of a microcosm of that game with the amount of shithousery and, you know, there's a VAR decision that waits for ages, the penalty's given, then you've got the sort of Ghanaians protecting the penalty spot. I don't know if I've seen that before. It's extraordinary that, you know, every Uruguayan having a go to slow it down. Andre Ayew, I mean, it was an absolutely terrible penalty, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was shockingly bad. I presume the gravity of the situation got to him. It was feebly struck. The run-up had no conviction, feebly struck, nowhere near the corner, and it was a very easy save for the Uruguayan keeper, really. He could have thrown his hat on it, as they say.
Paolo says, in the school of football drama, was this Ghana-Uruguay written by Tom Stoppard, 90-plus minutes of relentless suffering for all 22 players, and in the end it means absolutely nothing. Dan says, can we agree Uruguay-Ghana is the biggest derby in world football at 7,327 kilometers. It felt, Nadim, like it was going to explode at any time. You know, there was like, you know, there was the odd stamp. There was some, it was really sort of, it could have been, it was on a knife edge, I thought, from really getting out of hand.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And it is, you know, it is a derby now, isn't it? Because I'm sure the Uruguayans will get over this very, very quickly. The Ghanaians going to the corner, being 2-0 down. There'll be nothing to even speak of the next time they speak. I'm sure the World Cups don't matter to any of these teams. Definitely not Uruguay. I'm sure their players weren't crying about it. But yeah, it's a good tie, and it just continues just that little bit further. And it was very enjoyable. And I'll hold my hands up and say I've got the real mixed emotions, because being somebody who was born in Nigeria, who feels very Nigerian, to know that Ghana are the team that knocked out Nigeria and trying to qualify for the tournament, mm-hmm. but then seeing Ghana potentially go through to the round of 16, I'm like, do I like this? Do I not like this? Or do I just accept it? So I choose to accept it and just know Nigeria will be back.
Yeah, it's quite interesting you say that, name, because I think from here we sort of have quite a, I don't know if patronizing is the right word, but we sort of lump African football together, go, oh, this is great, there are three African teams through, but like there are obviously huge rivalries within that continent, right?
Yeah, 100%. And just think of it this way: if somebody came up to you from elsewhere and said, oh, it must be great for all you British teams to be doing so well together, you know, are you rooting for and you know, the Irish as well, they must love you guys, you know, I hope you're all rooting for each other to do so well. No, absolutely not. That's not a thing, never will be a thing, and it needs to be put in the bin. And that thing about Nigeria and Ghana, there may be some out there that say, fine, you know, we support the West African sort of nations, but when somebody's there at your expense, it's very hard to do. And I'm not going to say I'm the one that's bitter about it.
Sure.
But someone else might say I'm bitter about it, but I'm not going to say it myself.
Yeah, I noticed that the pile-on from Nigeria Twitter didn't take long. It was about a couple of minutes. And then they were off, you know, like, taunting and... Because that defeat in the playoffs really hurt. And I think a lot of Nigerians probably saw that coming as well, because mm-hmm. they always lose to Ghana. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I think also, yeah, I remember Algeria defeated, you know, they lost to Cameroon in the last minute. And I think seeing some of their fans, seeing Cameroon playing in at this World Cup is just heartbreaking, because, you know, they were so close to being there themselves. And Yeah, so it's not always necessarily, you know, the African teams support each other at all.
Later, we do have to talk about Luis Suarez, right? Because he was sort of pivotal to every bit of this game. He looks a bit like a Vets player to me. Like, he's really quite slow. But yeah, set up both goals. I mean, he was the first one, obviously, his shot was parried, and the second one is a lovely touch.
Yes.
And then all the pictures afterwards will be of him sitting on the bench, not being able to affect things.
Yes, that's exactly right. And the assist, well, you know, we're in this sort of like funny football era where someone having a shot that gets saved leads to an assist. He wasn't trying to assist anybody, but we'll give him one. We'll give him one. But then the second one was a nice bit of play that led to a great finish as well. And you can see as he was walking off the field, he was applauding the crowd, and you could see there was a real sense of appreciation. Maybe there was a hint from the crowd that, you know, the job was done, but they really do appreciate him for what he's done for the nation. And I think the bigger conversation about him now is like, because you mentioned the Vets player thing. People talking about how he might never play another game of football again. Like, this could literally be the end of his career. And that is an interesting spot for him to be in. But when you look at the fact that people are saying that maybe he can't play 90 minutes anymore, can you really have a long career from that point when that is the case? I think that should essentially be a foundation. Can a player finish a game? Yes or no? If the answer is no, then should you really be starting games? So it's a very, very tough spot for him to be in. You can see that, as was the case with Lukaku and stuff yesterday, I know we can poke fun at them. But I like the people who actually feel a level of emotion about disappointment, because it shows that they really wanted to be there. And that's probably the closest connection to the fans and people of that nation, because you feel the same sort of disappointment, except they feel a slightly different version of it because they've been involved in the thing that's led to the sadness. And in some ways, from an emotional standpoint, there are lots of people who say Suarez is a nice guy who know him, but I don't know him, so I can't say that too much. But yeah, the pain of going out when that football is everything to you, playing for your nation is everything to you. Because you can have a club side, but they can move on from you. But for him, you know, Uruguay is his everything. So for it to go out the way that he did, and him to be helpless watching it from the sideline, for some, that's a dream to see him suffer. But for others, you know, they feel real sympathy, because that is a very tough spot to be in.
If you can't play 90 minutes, Southern Amateur League Vets squad of 17 rolling subs. That's
good. Listen, I play an hour. That's it. If he wants to come down and play with me somewhere in North Manchester, he's more than welcome. How about that?
We did talk about, you know, the Rio Guayans being furious with the ref afterwards. And we've talked about sort of ref abuse, Barry, and you can understand the emotion. And it's sort of quite funny because it's Uruguay and they're sort of known for this sort of shithousery. But Sussex by the Sea says, look, the players went crazy. How are refs protected from that stuff? And it seems all commentators take it as normal. I guess we did as well. You know, it's sort of out of order, isn't it?
It was conspicuously out of order. That's kind of why I commented on it, because they were manhandling the ref as he left the pitch, and, you know, lads grabbing his shoulder, grabbing his arm, and that's not acceptable. Having said that, some of them have been booked. They will be punished accordingly, I suppose. No one was hurt, and they were understandably furious. There's a lot at stake, but as far as I'm concerned, their complaints were entirely justified. But, you know, obviously the ref isn't going to change the decision after the final whistle. It's not setting a good example to watching children or the parents of children who misbehave on the touchline of football matches, or guys who play Sunday League. But it's not up to the footballers of Uruguay to educate other people's children on how to behave on a pitch or off a pitch, and it's not. And people, adults who are watching, should be old enough to know better than to do that.
I agree with what Barry's saying there, and as well, I think that the interesting thing about this perspective when it comes to football is that the players have been punished. You know, I think if you look at it and say nothing's happened from it, then I think you are missing the point, because the referee literally was throwing us around like it's Christmas time. You know, you get one. That's what they deserved in that moment for that reaction. From the other side, I can understand why they'd be that frustrated. And to be honest, I think when players, you know, when you go on, speak to a referee. When you go and disagree with a referee, it's not necessarily to get them to change their mind, because more often than not, well, you know that they won't. Let's just let them sort of know that you're frustrated by it, and to know that maybe they didn't make the right decision. That could affect the referee further down the road. But in terms of, say, abuse, we can very quickly say that the players doing that is wrong, and it is. But then there'll be people who will be now reaching out to those players to say how bad they are as well, and to abuse them online. Not necessarily stuff from, you know, which could be racist and whatever, but it could just be abuse of a performance and the fact that they feel let down. But those same people who'll be typing to Luis Suarez saying, you're no good, you need to retire, you're nonsense, you're crap, you're this, that, and the other. They'll then also point at the screen and say you were disgraced for going up to a referee. So there's a whole system of abuse which exists where at times we sort of pick and choose as to what is okay and what's fair game and stuff that isn't. But interestingly, the only thing that really seems to get punished is the stuff which actually happens on the field, which we believe is the one which sets the worst example.
Slightly on a different note, Carl says, can we have more discussion on Infantino's insistence on always wearing white trainers with a dark suit? And is he taking the piss by leaving Uruguay Ghana at half-time and turning up at Portugal Korea for the second half? Ed, how do we feel about a suit and white trainer? I mean, I wouldn't say it's Infantino's biggest crime, if I'm being honest, but how do we feel about it?
Yeah, I can think of a few other things that he's done, but I mean, it is up there with, in terms of fashion crimes, I think it's up there. But I think the last time I saw it was Ralph Hasenhüttl earlier in the season on the touchline. And we all know what happened to him.
It's true.
So yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if there's a FIFA board who can give Infantino a vote of confidence. I think he does it for himself.
Oh yeah. He gives his own votes of confidence. But in terms of the game, his game choice, he did make, you know, maybe he knew what was going to happen because he, you know, he saw the two goals, that Uruguay scored and then he made it there for the dramatic finish in the other game.
Yusuf says, has Asia ever done better in a World Cup? First time they've had three qualifiers, if you count Australia as Asia. And the first time every continent is represented in the last 16, if you count Australia in Australasia. So it depends where you want Australia to be. They qualified through the Asian qualifying campaign, but obviously they're not in Asia. But I mean, I don't know, Barry, if that means there's some big change in the, you know, in the footballing landscape, or if it just does actually help for some of these sides having more fans. More fans there. I mean, it's obviously Australia, it's a long way to travel wherever they go. But, you know, certainly for those fans, and it's been commented a lot about, you know, how actually one of the positives of having this World Cup in Qatar has been the opportunity for Asian fans, African fans to get to a tournament.
Yeah, I've no idea what it tells us. If anything, I mean, we've seen in the past 24 hours how quickly things can change and how several of the teams that have made it through could easily not have made it through. It was sort of, a lot of it was in the lap of the gods. But yeah, if people who can't normally get to a tournament, and of course there's also the fact that this has been played mid-season, that could be having an effect. I really don't know. But if people who wouldn't normally get to tournaments are getting the opportunity to go to this one, then that's, I would say, possibly the only single benefit of having it where it is being staged.
All right, that'll do for part one. Ed, you're leaving us and not returning to talk about the other group. I hope you have an interesting Friday night planned that isn't talking to us.
Yes, thanks, Max. It's going to be excellent.
Okay, good. What is it?
I'm going to a gig.
I'm intrigued now. Oh, to see who?
Alberosi.
Okay, they're definitely too cool for me.
It's a single person, a reggae person.
All right, okay, yeah. This is like when I thought Dua Lipa was a band as well. It's very hard to keep up.
Come on, keep up with the kids, Max.
I'll Google them now. Have a lovely time. Nadim and Barry will be with me for part two to talk about Serbia, Switzerland, and Cameroon, Brazil. Welcome to part two of the Ghanaian Football Weekly. Just a bit of breaking news that's happened in between us ending part one and this part beginning. It was about 20 seconds. Ghana head coach Otto Addo is stepping down from his role after that defeat to Uruguay. He's going to focus on his other job. He's a talent coach with Borussia Dortmund. He said before the game on the subject of revenge, I know a lot of people were seeking revenge. I don't think this way. And I told the players they shouldn't think this way as well. I'm a strong believer. If you don't seek revenge, you will get more blessings. We were not looking for that. We were trying to win this game. If it wasn't Uruguay, we'd have tried it against another team. So it was not so important. It came more from the outside. What a wonderful message. Okay, then Group G, Brazil win it. Switzerland finished on the same number of points as them. Cameroon on four, Serbia just on one. It was kind of winner takes all between Serbia and Switzerland. Switzerland won 3-2, and Nick Ames was there and joins us now. Hey, Nick.
Hey there, guys. How are we doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. You've just come from sort of the frantic scenes at full time.
Yes, I have. And like, try as I might, I never learn. That game got to about 65 minutes in, and you think, oh, we've had a fairly good, clean game of football here. About 50 minutes of which was rattling good fun. I mean, that first half was, you know, what it lacked in sort of quality and tactical discipline was outstanding in terms of chances and being open. We saw a Serbia team that, as we know, needed to win. A point was enough for Switzerland. And Serbia just piled out of the traps, basically. Had a bit of a scare early on. And then just committed about 7 men forward in every attack, leaving loads of space behind them. Made for a madcap start. Jordan Checiri opening the scoring for Switzerland. And I'm sure we've been over before the context of the Albanian eagle celebration on this pod, which caused a lot of controversy when Checiri and Xhaka both scored in 2018 when these sides met. This time Checiri eschewed it. He just instead did a silence finger to his mouth to the Serbian fans, which is a bit incendiary, but not as incendiary, because they've been booing him very heavily, obviously. And then we just had a chaotic first half. Serbia scored two really nicely taken goals through Mitrovic and Vlahovic, and they deserve them. They've been creating a lot of chances, both from set pieces and open play. But you never thought for one second that they'd be able to sit back and hold on to it. You always felt Switzerland could get in behind, as they did. Widmer crossed just before half-time. Embolo, who's having a good tournament, his finishing is not always that reliable, but he's always there, converted it for 2-2. And you thought, we've got a rattling good second half coming up, but Switzerland took the lead straight away, came out again, very loose pressure on the ball from Serbia, which was a problem for them all game. Lovely knockback by Vargas, I think it was, and Freuler, the Nottingham Forest player, drilled in at the same time as his club side was playing a friendly against Stoke at Loughborough University, which I'm sure he was thinking about.
We've already covered that in part one, actually.
I'm sure. I thought we might do a separate bit, but there we go. And then, yeah, football-wise, that was basically it. Not much worth talking about, but then I don't even know what minute it was. Two-thirds of the way through the game, maybe. Mitrovic, Serbia getting more and more desperate now. They're just sort of their constructive ability from earlier has gone. They're cooked, basically. Mitrovic flings himself down for a silly dive for a penalty. And then it all kicks off on the touchline, and no one really knew what had happened. Serbia were screaming for a pen, all their subs coming off the bench, the usual. But then the Swiss players started getting involved, and Dragan Stojkovic, who I think Serbia could have done with on the pitch in his prime as a player, is their coach now, came on and started demonstrating. And we only found out on replays that it appears that Granit Xhaka might have grabbed his genital area in the direction
of the bench, which
was a piece of shithousery that was probably of a piece with what people might have expected from this game. So that all kicked off for a while. 7 or 8 minutes later, I mean, I don't really understand Serbian or indeed most of the languages that Switzerland speaks, so I don't know which set of fans this necessarily was, but the Tannoy in the 77th minute warned the fans to quit. I think he said discriminatory shouting and chants. So it's unfortunate because until then, the behaviour had been fairly good. There was one little skirmish near me in the crowd, maybe just before Freuler's goal. And then at the end, right towards the end, was another little bit of aggro involving Xhaka, and I think it was Milenkovic, maybe the goalkeeper as well, and a few others. Again, haven't seen replays of that because was busy filing, but it kicked off again. So there were 11 bookings in the game, which should tell you quite a lot about how it degenerated in the second half. It feels a bit of a shame to me that a really good game of football was sort of ground to a bit of a weird halt like that, but it's also not surprising at all. So we shall see what the consequences are.
Cheers, Nick. Thanks for coming on, mate.
Thank you, guys. Take care.
I actually thought maybe, Nedim, this game would have kicked off more than it did, given the rivalry between the two. I know there are a few bit sort of fracas, and Nick was there, so he's got much better feel for sort of what that was like. But I was expecting even more fireworks.
Really? Even more? Do you mean from basically just the start of the game? Or what were you thinking? Please tell me through it.
I didn't feel like it ever really kicked off. There were like a couple of minor fracas.
Well, it's probably worth mentioning, Max, that we're recording like very soon after the final whistle. And I was inclined to say, can we have 15 minutes? Because I really think Granit Xhaka's going to do something.
Yeah,
And I think he still could.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
Footballers are funny, aren't they? Even Sunday League footballers. Like, if a player, like, grabs his crotch, like, so what? Like, good for you. I don't understand why that would elicit so much rage. Yeah. I know there is massive rivalry between these two sides.
Yeah, and I think as well, it's the person doing it. You know, they clearly don't like him. I think he's probably a big reason. One of the reasons why there were 7 yellow cards given to Serbians in that second half. He's obviously not too well liked. But tell me something more predictable than at the end of the game. Which two players from opposing sides would be going up against each other? So it's Mitrovic and Xhaka going head to head. Who would have thought such a thing would happen? Yeah. But the rivalry's there. But I think to give them a bit of credit, even through all the madness, like there's still two good footballing sides. So ultimately, they probably wanted to do that as well. And whilst Serbia was still in with a chance, they couldn't really go too far over the top because they still had an end objective. And in the end, once that seems to be going out the window, that's when some of the rage seemed to kick in at people, maybe grabbing a crotch and directing it in their vicinity.
The third goal, it was beautiful, Barry, wasn't it? The first Nottingham Forest player to score at a World Cup since Pierre van Hooijdonk in 1998. But the assist from Vargas, yeah, I thought it was a total delight.
It was. Ball over the top. And Vargas had his neat little flick and Freuler scored into the corner. I thought it was the second best goal of the game.
All right.
And I thought Vlahovic's goal was the standout goal of the game. And I was thinking, that really reminds me of a goal I've seen before.
Oh, really?
Who could it be? And then I checked.
Is it Max?
I think it was the Premier League goal of the day. I can't remember the weekend or year, but it was a young whippersnapper named Ned Inoue.
Oh, my God.
Playing for Sunderland.
Stop it, Barry. People don't want to hear about this.
He dribbled through the Chelsea defence and scored an exactly similar finish into the exact same corner. Except he did that on his own, Max. He did that on his own. For Serbia, it was a two-man job because Dusan Tadic had to get involved and help.
They're just not as good as me. That's the thing, Barry.
Well, clearly not.
I don't think these goals are anything similar at all. Maybe,
I think it's like that famous Messi goal that was played side by side with the
Bears. Right.
I think if you play the Nedun goal beside the Vlahovic goal, the similarities are remarkable.
Listen, Dusan Vlahovic and myself, both known for having killer left feet. That's the key thing there. Just remember that, Max.
But like that Vlahovic goal, basically, Shaqiri gives it away. Like Tadic plays a pass which doesn't go to Vlahovic. A Swiss defender has a chance to clear the thing and just kicks it.
Don't worry about that,
Vlahovic.
Max. Doesn't matter.
Who finishes it?
All these words you're saying don't matter, Max. I've been compared to Vlahovic scoring a goal at the World Cup. Everything you said does not matter. It's fine.
On the third goal, thanks to Emerson Gunnar, who was watching on Swiss TV with French commentary, and that goal got a full oulala, c'est fantastique. But fantastic, I should say.
Sorry, was that the best Freuler goal or the Nedum goal?
That was because the Freuler goal, the Vlahovic goal was just not a great goal. But he said the best bit was when the Serbians were attacking her in the box. The commentator was just saying, attention, attention. He said, can we get Jonathan Pearce to just scream, watch out, while Senegal are attacking England? And Mbolo, I thought he made a good point. I think he has had a good World Cup, Nedum, and I think he's a good player. He's still, you know, he's not like the finished article, but he leads a line in a way a lot of teams don't seem to have a player that can do that at this tournament.
Yeah, totally agree. And he's chipping in with the goals as well. You can see that his presence makes a big difference. And even for that Freuler goal, the long ball that got played up, it wasn't the best of balls, but he made something out of it. And I think the left centre-back was panicking a little bit when he saw him because he knows physically he's not as good as Mbolo is. So he did make a huge difference, and he's going to be a tough matchup for whoever they go up against. And that's, you know, that's what you need. You know, they've got some teams that feel like they're probably short through the middle, but in Mbolo scoring, linking up and putting himself in the right areas, you know, it's good to see. And then he's also the guy who had the most unique celebration I've probably seen at a World Cup where you apologize for scoring because you scored against your home nation, which is, very strange in itself.
No crotch grabbing there.
Not yet.
this game seemed to me, it's like it started in the 90th minute and played its way down to the first. Like
Benjamin Button.
Yes.
The Benjamin Button of football matches.
Switzerland had 3 shots on goal inside 30 seconds, the first 30 seconds. And it's like they didn't really start feeling each other out until the last 10 or 15 minutes when the game had more or less died on its arse. It was a weird game, but a very enjoyable one.
Yeah, and actually there was the only real moment of like jeopardy. Okay, Serbia were ahead for a bit, and then Switzerland came back into it. The real jeopardy in this group was after Cameroon had scored in the 92nd minute, where suddenly you were like, well, hang on, if Serbia score now, then Cameroon are through, or if Switzerland score, then Brazil are second in the group, which would have been sort of completely ridiculous. Everyone's looking at how the draw pans out. And that header from Abubakar, who's already scored one of the best goals of the tournament, that sort of ridiculous scoop the other day. There's just something so casual about him scoring a brilliant header, Nadim, and then getting a red card and just sort of shaking the ref's hand and going, yeah, fair enough, and sort of holding his shirt off, waving, going, I've been sent off. I don't think I've ever seen a more casual red in my life.
Yeah, it was so iconic. He knows how big a goal that is. He scored a goal against Brazil and they might win the game. And then he's obviously thrown the shirt off, then brought the shirt back and raised it so everyone could see, this is me. Even though everybody already knew, he's like, yes, this is me. I just did this. And then the referee's coming over and, you know, That's one of the referees I had in the MLS. Can't say I loved him, to be honest. But over he comes. I've got a surprise for you, my friend. Here you go. Shook his hand. And all the players knew as well. This is a very, very surreal red card, especially given the fact that there was 7 more minutes to go. Even though that goal was very important, surely he'd rather play with 11 men? Because one of my friends who was watching it with, he was saying, you know, it's okay. Such a big goal, such a big moment, so on and so forth. Well, I said, well, if he did it in the 82nd minute, would you say it's fine? Or is it just because now it's pulse 90, you assume that it's great, even though the amount of time left in theory is kind of the same? It was very strange, but credit to him. He's obviously scored some really good goals. And yeah, I've enjoyed watching him. But yeah, it's a strange moment to get yourself a second yellow card for helping your team possibly have a chance to go through. But there we are.
It's a stupid law. It's a stupid law, Barry, isn't it?
Yes, completely. And I'm not really sure what the logic behind it is. There's... Even stupid laws, there tends to be some sort of logic behind them. I don't have a clue what the logic behind this one is. Is it something to do with crowd incitement? Or Nadim's raising a hand?
No, I just remember when it first came in, actually. I think it was my first season, I think 2004, 2005. And it was after, I think, Tim Cahill did it. He either did it in the season before or he was the first player to get booked for it. But to talk about Abubakar, imagine if that was the goal that got them through and he couldn't play in the next round because he got sent off.
Yeah.
The decision that he made himself, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I know the law's weird, but he knows the law, which is why he shook the referee's hand. Like, that's for me, not to be disrespectful to all of them, but I'll say 99% of them, strikers are really weird. That's such a weird decision.
If you knew you had like a hot-headed striker, like a Mitrovic or someone who might take their shirt off, would you as manager make them wear a kind of onesie, a kind of sewed, so that if they tried to take the shirt off, all they'd succeed in doing is giving themselves a massive wedgie, but they wouldn't be able to get it off. And so then they wouldn't get a booking.
Fair play to him as well. He also managed to go full John Terry by removing his shirt, but leaving the armband on over his naked bicep.
Aiden says, not really a question, please talk about how strange it is that Rodrigo is playing in the same team as Dani Alves, who is older than Rodrigo's dad, because it feels quite mad. It was nice to see Dani Alves out there. And, you know, apart from that, we saw Anthony spinning around a bit. And it could have backfired on Brazil, Barry, couldn't it? But ultimately, it doesn't matter.
No, I mean, if they finish second in the group, they would face who instead of
Portugal.
South Korea? Portugal instead. It's much of a muchness, I think, isn't it? I'll be honest, I wasn't paying a huge amount of attention to this game, and not a lot seemed to happen, but everyone has been wanging on about Brazil's incredible strength in depth, so they lost this game fielding a lot of reserve players, but I think it was a shot to nothing for them, really, and if it had backfired, I don't think it would be the end of the world. They'd be playing Portugal instead of South Korea. Meh.
Do you go with that, Nadim? I sort of feel Portugal is a tougher game than South Korea.
But they're both through, you know what I mean? So you never really know. You never really know. South Korea got a very good result earlier today. You just don't know. But for Brazil, the thing which I've noticed from looking at the standings, so they have finished top, but they're the lowest scorers in their group. And that's not really something I would have had in my mind in terms of how they are with the attacking flair that they have, because it feels like they're just basically playing just like 4 or 5 defenders and then everybody else just go and do whatever you need to do. So for them to finish on that sort of level is interesting. I do find that interesting. But for them, they're still on track, and everyone's mythical semi-final of Argentina-Brazil, I think it still exists. So let's see if they can get there, because the pressure's going to be on a little bit now that they've lost the game, and maybe they can dampen some of those expectations just a little bit.
Just finally, this part, thanks to John Bruin, who texted me to say, I think Seb Hutchinson and Andros Townsend were doing the comms for the Switzerland game, weren't they? And John just said, my mate just asked me if Andros Townsend was Andy Townsend deciding to use his full name.
there was a lovely bit in this commentary where Serbia got a corner and all their rather large defenders lumbered up into the penalty area. And Seb Hutchinson described it as big man heaven.
Some of them, one of their centre backs is I do love them, sort of big, galumphing Serbian men, aren't they? The two centre backs. I sort of enjoy watching them not be technically amazing footballers, but, you know, very much do a job.
And quite scary looking men.
Yes.
Yeah. And at one point during the game as well, Andros announced that he had a flight to catch later. He didn't want much added time because he had a flight home to catch for his daughter's birthday party, which I thought was very cute. I'm wondering, is he flying home for his daughter's birthday party and then flying back, or is his stint over? Because it's the kind of thing I suspect Troy would certainly do, and Andros is hopefully a chip off the old block.
It's not great for your carbon footprint, but it's wonderful as a parent, isn't it? Anyway, I can't talk on that subject. Right, that'll do for part two. We'll do any other business in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So then tomorrow, the knockouts begin. Netherlands versus the USA and Argentina, Australia. The Netherlands and the USA have played each other only in friendlies. Netherlands have won 4 out of 5. US men's national team manager Greg Berhalter said that midfielder Christian Pulisic is looking pretty good to take part in the game. He'll need confirmation today. Gio Reyna ready to step in if Pulisic is deemed unfit. Barry, we've already discussed Netherlands. We don't know how good they are. You still feel the US have got a chance here, don't you?
Yeah, I would give them a chance, actually. The Netherlands had quite serene progress through their group, but I saw all their games, and I wasn't hugely impressed with what I saw. Obviously, Cody Gakpo is playing a blinder for them, and he's scored in every game so far. But on the evidence of what I've seen from the USA, I would definitely give them a very good chance in that game. Very good chance.
Maybe it's because I'm surrounded by Americans in terms of who I'm working for, but I'm learning more and more about them, and I'm watching their games more intently than, say, I would have done in the past. And they're feeling not necessarily confident, but there is a sense of belief that they can cause an upset here. And there isn't that big a difference between the two sides at this moment, because the Netherlands, they did qualify top and stuff like that, but they didn't really impress anybody on that journey. I think at times their attacking is quite slow. They're quite labored in terms of how they try and build out. Whereas for the USA, defensively, as we saw against England, it can be solid, but they do have a huge threat on the break with the speed that they have. And there's some really good players in there. And I think if Pulisic can be fit and, you know, potentially bringing in a Gio Reyna, who hasn't had as much football as, say, he would have liked at this point, they are a really, really dangerous side. And I'm actually going to that game tomorrow, and I'm kind of thinking USA are going to do it. And if they do, I think people have to take them a little bit more seriously. And because the Netherlands, you know, they seem like they're a good team by name, but at the moment it's not really by nature, because they're not really showing that much, to be honest.
Meanwhile, Argentina, Australia, I mean, it would be extraordinary, Barry, if Australia got through in this game, wouldn't it? I mean, it's 6 a.m. in Australia, certainly in parts of Australia, and that'll be, the atmosphere will be amazing in those squares that we've seen the full at 2:30 in the morning.
I think it will be one of the biggest upsets in World Cup history if Australia win this game. And I can't see anything other than a fairly emphatic Argentina victory. But you never know. Argentina have already been beaten once. No one saw that coming. I can't see it. I mean, it would be incredible, and I think I'd be quite pleased for Australia. I like Australia. I'm a big fan of the, as a country, I know a lot of Australians, and they're all very nice people. But, they can't.
Yeah, I can't imagine the existential crisis Marcella will have tomorrow on the pod if that happens. Nadim, your thoughts on this one?
So I'll start by telling you a story. So I went to the Australia game versus Denmark, and in the first half, like, respectfully, they were pathetic. Yeah, they were really, really bad, like exceptionally bad. But in the second half, I thought they played well. And bizarrely, Denmark were getting worse, even though they're the ones that needed to do something. And in that game, as was the case with Suarez pointing up at the scoreboard today, there was a point where Australia dropped a third because there'd been a goal in the other game and it went up on the scoreboard. And literally a minute later, Matthew Lecky went through and scored and the whole energy changed around that game. So yes, they do arrive as really significant underdogs. And they're sort of, if you go and look at the ceiling versus their floor is quite low from what I've seen, but they can be competitive. I think when you look at Argentina for the way that they started the tournament, you'd say they have a chance. But the way Argentina have been at the moment, with the amount of fans that they have there and the energy that they play at, not many people are going to be putting money on Australia. Let's just say that. And I think if Argentina play anywhere near their best, then as Barry would say, like, you know, this could be a very heavily one-sided game on scoreline.
James says, on a scale of 9 to 10, how disrespectful is it that the BBC pundits are discussing England, France as if Senegal don't exist? I don't know if you saw this, Nadim. I think they were talking about you shouldn't play Kyle Walker against Senegal because you've got to save him for Mbappe. And I'm sitting there going, oh, this is dangerous talk.
Yeah. So in regards to certain bits of coverage and sort of perceptions of things which I've heard, I don't know if they're fully essential. They're not really like watching every game that's out here. I wouldn't say that's for all of them, but maybe one or two. So they're being very much led. And I think they're sort of putting such an England focus on it that they're missing the point, because there have been so many games which have gone on, which have really sort of been a lesson in terms of how certain teams play and what they're doing and who arrives with real momentum. And I think if they do decide to overlook Senegal, like, you know, as champions of Africa, they're not too bad, you could say. I think they could be in for a big, big shock here. And I don't like it really when they do make everything so specific to England, that try and educate people overall about the tournament itself and the merits of the other teams who are still in the competition. Because, you know, making it to the round of 16 is an achievement for everybody. And as a consequence, surely you have to take them seriously. Barring Qatar, I think everyone else actually qualified. So surely you should realistically sort of tell the nation about what to expect. Because lo and behold, as is the case with football, probably around the world, for those things that you don't know, you tend to underestimate. And if England do underestimate Senegal because people are telling them not to worry about them, then they could be in a lot of trouble. Because Senegal and that Netherlands group, they probably had the three best performances overall, and they might not finish first. But a lot of people say they've been the best team in that group.
Yeah, I mean, I love it when the English punditocracy gets ahead of themselves. But I mean, the specific instance you're referring to for our overseas listeners was when Gary Lineker was explaining to his panel of pundits why Kyle Walker should not be played against Senegal. He's saying you can't risk injuring him because he's the only defender on the planet with the speed required to deal with Kylian Mbappe. I think it's a bit unfair to say he's getting ahead of himself. And I think he specifically said, I'm not getting ahead of myself, but in Trent Alexander-Arnold and Kieran Trippier, we have perfectly adequate cover. They just don't happen to be as quick as Kyle Walker. But obviously, if Gareth Southgate now drops Kyle Walker or doesn't start him and Senegal win, that will be seized upon as the reason for the defeat.
The wider point, should England manage to get over that hurdle of playing against Senegal, is Mbappe has come into his own playing on the left-hand side because of the change when Hernandez, I think it was Lucas, got injured and Tail ended up coming on. And Tail's the more attacking of the two brothers. And now you can see how their link-up has changed. So for England, you can talk about Kyle Walker, you can talk about whoever you want at right-back, but who's going to be playing on that right side to support it when it goes to a 2v1, when it's Mbappe and Hernandez? And you'd think that they would know that, but maybe they wouldn't if they've just missed those games because maybe they're doing something else. But anyway, that's not.
Are you saying a lot of pundits are on the golf course? And I don't know why, Nedim, why you're talking about who should play midfield for England against France, because we haven't beaten Senegal yet. Can I ask you?
Listen, I just fell into the trap.
Yeah, can I ask you a question, Nedim? And I don't mean this in a sort of gotcha way, but we've sort of seen people who've gone out to Qatar. Obviously, there's a lot of talk before the tournament. We've seen people sort of go out and then say, actually, I'm having a really lovely time here, and none of what you people have over-criticized it. And there are, I can see some real positives to this tournament, you know, as we said in a previous part about fans from other countries. You know, football is not just for Europe. It's just not for South America. It's for the whole world. Mm-hmm. And that is good. Actually, having no alcohol is good. And if it's going to be in a Muslim country, and why shouldn't it be, then alcohol be harder to get. And that's not a problem. But I just wonder, like, are you having a great time? And And or do you, are you conscious of what has happened before with the migrant workers and the treatment of LGBTQ plus?
I 100% acknowledge everything that's happened before, and those conversations shouldn't go away. But I can also reference the fact that when I walk down from my apartment, I walk to a section which has lots of fans, and where we are is linked to all the different metro systems. So in any given day, depending on what the game is, you'll see a big group of fans that comes through that way. And yesterday, there were probably 10,000-15,000 Morocco fans singing and dancing through the streets. And there's been so much of that. You can tell whether it's Ecuadorians, it's Argentinians, it's everything. And there's a huge sense of excitement, not because the World Cup is, say, essentially here, but it's because it's the World Cup. And for me, that's where, for myself personally, I say after the acknowledgement, like I feel really proud to be at a World Cup. I'm watching some of the best players in the world and I'm seeing fans from all over the world. It's a very unique experience to literally see people from every corner of the globe all being one place at the same time. And I've watched every game. Like, I don't know, maybe it's because I'm new to this whole punditry thing, but I love football. I love World Cups and I've loved being a part of something that's linked so many people together.
I don't know what you were expecting, but I suppose, of course, there are nice people from all parts of the globe there and nice people in Qatar, you know? So like, I think that's quite interesting from that sort of coverage of actually, this is really nice. But it was a bit like Russia was really nice, wasn't it? Because people are like Russian, there are lots of nice Russians and people love football and lots of fans jumping around is really great. I think the two things can coexist, I guess.
Yeah, they can, but I think it's the acknowledgement of the fact that there are two things, and I definitely do take that on board. And as I say, I'm really fortunate because it's not like I talk to every group of fans that I see, but it's been nice to have a different perspective. And so I'm working for ESPN, and with ESPN, there's a lot of coverage about the American team, the Mexican team, the Argentinian team, the Brazilian team, and the energy that they have towards the game. They're so passionate. Like the day when Argentina played Mexico in this green room bit where we sort of like watch games, there's a full split. You've got 20 Argentinians that side, 20 Mexicans that side. There's the passion when the goals are going in. It's so intense. And it's nice because it makes you look at the World Cup from a different perspective instead of solely thinking about the fate of whichever team you want to get behind. And to see those out on the streets, like I'm getting to any game I can get tickets for, I'm going to, because everything just feels really, really remarkable and special. And I think this thing itself, for the flaws that it has, there are some significant upsides. And the fact that you could, in theory, go to every game, but then you fast forward 4 years and the next game might be an 8-hour flight. Oh, sorry, like a 4-hour flight away. You might be driving for 2-3 hours. So there are upsides to the way things have been done. But like, as you mentioned, there are two sides to it. But I think there needs to be, in some ways, more of an acknowledgement of the two sides, because when you step out, if you love football, it's an incredible footballing experience right now. And yeah, it's, as I say, I've had an incredible time, to be honest.
Fair play to Tom Kerridge, who tweeted out, "I had a cracking time with Jermaine Genius and co during my international commentating debut on Tuesday. Big shout out to Danny Gabadon for stepping into the kitchen and covering me. Available for Manchester United games in the new year." And a good stat from Johnny Blaine saying, "There is no player called Gary at a World Cup for the first time since 1982. It's huge news, isn't it? Anyway, look, that'll do for today. Cheers, Barry.
Cheers.
Thanks, Nathan.
Thank you very much.
Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove with Silas Gray. Our executive producer is Max Sanderson. We'll be back tomorrow with the start of the knockouts.
This is The Guardian.